Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. I like the idea of putting a few sacred cows out to pasture, but what do you say to a winemaker who compares Australian Shiraz to raspberry-scented motor oil? Well, first you want to know what's his angle. With Monty Doon's Randall Graham, that opinion gives you entree to one of the most original minds in the wine world. Now, he shares that originality with another of our guests today, bread baker Jim Leahy. Now, Jim is the unsung hero who started the craze for the no-knead bread technique. So today, it's two originals, your calls, and much more. That's this hour on The Splendid Table. This episode of The Splendid Table is brought to you by the new 2011 Hyundai Equus. Discover the Hyundai Equus, the new premium luxury sedan from Hyundai, offering first-class refinement and features. And take the Insider Survey for this podcast at podcastinsidersurvey.com. That's podcastinsidersurvey.com.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Well, it's good to be with you this week. I hope you are having a great post-holiday weekend with Feed Up. You know that you can always get to us with questions and whatever else is on your mind by sending us an email at splendidtable.org or call 800-537-5252, which is exactly what Gary from Indianapolis has done today. Gary, good to hear from you. What do you want to talk about?
Oh, I've been thinking about a dish that I was blessed to have eaten when I was a young music student in Los Angeles. I studied with a maestro named Moacir Santos, and his wonderful wife, Cleo, would make feijoada on Sundays. And it was such a delectable dish. I would like to know how to recreate it.
Ooh, why don't you describe the dish for people who don't know what feijoada is?
She would do it a little differently than some Brazilians would, but she always started with a bed of long grain white rice.
Right.
And then the black beans that she would put on top were sometimes she would cook them with an orange, sometimes an orange with a spice. She would cook them all day long and make this incredible black bean that went on this layering thing. And then the feijoada was like the topping to all of that. And she sometimes would do it with fish, mostly with meat. She'd start with a little Brazilian sausage, and she'd reduce that in a pan till it were very small pieces. Then she'd put a little bit of farina on that and make it so it was a little crispy. Then she put different cuts of meat in it, and then that would go on top of the black beans. And then she did a reduction of red peppers that were, until it was almost nuclear waste. It was just light pink. And three or four drops, you would break out in an amazing sweat eating this fabulous meal. And the more you eat, the more you'd want because the little heat would make you hungrier.
Yes.
It was incredible.
It's one of the reasons I think certain plumpettes of us, I'm referring to myself, who adore chilies, perhaps should maybe stop eating them. But that's another issue entirely. Well, for those who haven't run across this, feijoada, couldn't you say, I mean, it's almost the national dish of Brazil. And there are many ways of making it. And I think to duplicate hers, by the way, it's so interesting because, as I recall, orange and some sort of hot sauce, usually made, you know, with very hot chilies, is always a gilding to it. So, and the other thing I remember in the days when I ate it in the 70s in New York, there was kale, steamed or sautéed kale on the side. But it was all of the things you talked about. And this is what I would do. I mean, essentially, you know how to make the rice, right? And by the way, one of the things that you may want to do with the rice is sauté in olive oil or butter, okay?
Well, that's the key ingredient I forgot to mention. Everything was drizzled with Brazilian olive oil or Portuguese olive oil.
Yeah, well, what could be bad, right? Exactly.
Yep.
But the idea is that when you're making the rice, make a base where maybe you sauté some orange zest and some cumin and some garlic and some onion, and then add the rice and add the liquid and let that cook. That, though, may be one of the last things that you do. And the first thing you want to do is stew those meats. So start with the sausage. And I wonder if she cooked that sausage in a skillet and maybe cooked it in wine. Did she ever use wine in any of this?
She did. But when she started with the sausage first, she would the sausage would be – she'd take it out of the casing and she'd make it in little pieces in a cast iron skillet.
I see.
And sometimes she would make feijoada, or she would make farofa, which was that kind of sausage with just the crumbs, like a farina, but a little finer than farina.
Yeah, yeah.
And that would go on top of the black beans.
You know what? I just realized something. I could go on and on about this, but it would be guesswork from memory. If you go to the Savour magazine website, they did a big piece on the food of Brazil, and they did a big piece on feijoada. I don't remember. Yes, and I don't remember where when it was, but if you go on the site, it's going to be there. It was within the past several years, and I think you're going to find the entire recipe. This is probably one of the all-time great party dishes, too.
Oh, it's incredible.
And you're making me so hungry.
Me, too.
Hey, thank you, sir. Thanks so much for the idea, too. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
You talk about a perfect dish for right now and for entertaining a mob. It's feijoada. Okay, more calls coming up. The number is 800-537-5252 or get to us at splendidtable.org. Ever noticed how many big thinkers wind up being involved with wine in one way or another? Take Randall Graham, the philosopher come winemaker, who started out with a bang when he told California winemakers to ditch the cabs and the chardonnays because not only were they dead wrong for the climate, they tasted dead wrong. His stand was that California winemaking should be driven by the wines of France's southern Rhone Valley, where the climate is the same and the queen of grapes is Syrah. And then he went on to prove his point with his Bonnie Doon vineyards. Now, all the while, Randall was writing, and those writings have been collected in his book, Been Doon So Long, A Randall Graham Vinthology. Randall, good to have you back.
Thank you so much.
Randall, you brought in a bottle of your Syrah. I'd like to talk about this grape.
I love to talk about Syrah. It's one of my very favorite grapes.
Okay, but now, there's Syrah that is based where? It's the Rhone area, right?
There is Syrah, and there's what is called Shiraz by the Australians. And the two are genetically identical. It's the same grape,
right?
But they are two different species, at least stylistically.
And this is where you get a little bit upset, as I recall.
Yes, I do. Proper Syrah comes from France.
Uh-huh.
Proper Syrah is savory, it's aromatic, it's elegant. It has a lot stylistically in common with great Burgundy, with Pinot Noir. I think that's really sort of its platonic essence.
Mm-hmm.
And Australian Shiraz is a bit of a confection, shall we say. It's a wine that's, if not sweet, it's profoundly overripe. Certainly, I don't mean to say that every single Australian Shiraz is this way. But these are wines that I think often are rather cynically constructed with the aim of seducing the consumer and really kind of slightly pandering to the kind of lowest common denominator of wine drinker.
But now there's another side to that, that when you have someone who's new to wine, these wines are extremely appealing. It's a doorway into more. I mean, isn't that another way of looking at
that
it?
That is another way of looking at it. I'm not sure if that door leads anywhere apart from sort of more wines like that. But I think this style of wine works on our physiology. I mean, we as human beings are programmed to gravitate towards ripe flavors. I think it's in our DNA, essentially, to favor ripe flavors over unripe flavors. And I think the appreciation of less ripe flavors is something, a matter of acculturation.
You actually have referred to Australian Shiraz as the McDonald's of the Syrah world. Is this sort of a cheapening of what a great grape can be for you?
Well, let me give you another way of thinking about it. The French make a very interesting distinction between what they call vin de terroir and vin d'effort, wines of terroir and wines of effort.
Terroir meaning?
Terroir meaning a sense of place. Wines that somehow can carry with them, carry through the taste of the wine, a sense of the place that is consistent from year to year, mm-hmm. independent of the winemaker. And you can almost think of these two as ends of a continuum. A wine of effort is a wine that bears the strong stylistic imprint of the winemaker himself or herself, as my daughter would have me say. And the problem with that is that it essentially relies upon the intelligence of the winemaker, which is quite limited. Whereas a wine of terroir, the winemaker's contribution is much more discreet, and what the winemaker is really trying to do is amplify the sense of place rather than his contribution.
Uh-huh.
I would argue that a wine that expresses terroir, because it expresses a sense of the earth, there's a certain mineral aspect to it. I think these are flavors that we apprehend with a different part of our brain, and I think it affects us almost viscerally. I think it just affects us in almost an emotional fashion, in the way that a made-up wine, there's a word that's used sometimes called spoofulated, which means a wine that has been messed with, mm-hmm. seriously messed with. And, you know, those perfect wines, those wines that are just like too perfect to taste, you can admire them, but you don't love them. You can like them, but you can't love them. And you're never haunted by them. These are never wines that you say, you know, I must have that wine again. I must have that wine again. I didn't quite get it. I want to really understand it.
Is there a way of knowing when you're literally looking for a wine? How do you know the difference? You know, you're looking at a collection of Syrahs. You're looking at wines made from a particular grape in a wine shop.
That's a very good question. I would begin by the country of origin, and then I would look at the label itself. And, you know, this is kind of pretty much of a soft science, but I would stay away from goofy labels. You know, and this is from a reformed goofy label producer.
Randall, you really almost originated the concept of the kind of out there label.
I may have indeed. And the reason I did that was, A, to amuse myself, B, to introduce people to styles of wine, varietals that they may never have heard of before. I wanted mm-hmm. to make it friendlier. But now you go into a wine store and every single label seems to have a goofy animal on it, an outrageous, shocking mm-hmm. name. And I think ultimately it needs to be about the wine. And I would like our labels, certainly in the future, to be more referential to the wine and really connote a sense of what the wine is up to, if you will.
Randall, thank you.
My great pleasure.
Winemaker Randall Graham is creator of Bonny Doon Vineyard. His book, Been Doon So Long, A Randall Graham Vinthology. Coming up, the original five-minute bread from the man who created it, the Stearns on Great Cheap Eats, and the Dolls of India. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. This episode of The Splendid Table is brought to you by the new 2011 Hyundai Equus. We're surveying our podcast audience to learn about your favorite wine pairings for holiday dinners, your most loved kitchen appliances, and more. Please go to podcastinsidersurvey.com and tell us what you think, and we'll let you know what other listeners of this podcast said in an upcoming episode. And while you're there, be sure to check on the new 2011 Hyundai Equus, featuring first-class everything, including heated and cooled seats, complete with driver back massage. Discover a new kind of luxury and the special survey for this podcast, all brought to you by the new 2011 Hyundai Equus, at podcastinsidersurvey.com. That's podcastinsidersurvey.com. You know, the most copied bread recipe, maybe in history, could be the 5-minute no-knead bread formula that New York Times food columnist Mark Bittman put into print. The downloads are legion. Now, a lot of people got a piece of the action with this new way to make bread, between the books and the articles and the blogs. But the one person we haven't heard from is the man who invented the concept, Jim Leahy. He started the Sullivan Street Bakery in New York City in 1994. His bread is the essence of what that word artisan should mean. It tastes of wheat. And I mean wheat as in ripe and sweet and nut-like and earthy. That's Jim's bread, and it is ridiculously easy to make. Finally, Jim Leahy has done a book. It's called My Bread, The Revolutionary No Work, No Need Method. Jim Leahy, welcome.
Well, thank you, Lynn. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
Well, Jim, I have to say, this technique is so simple. I mean, you take flour, salt, yeast, water. You literally stir it. You don't knead it at all. You put it on the counter. You forget about it for a very long time. And then you make bread.
Yes.
How did you come up with this?
Well, you know, it kind of accidentally, I was down in Florida trying to figure out whether or not I could make good bread down there. And I noticed that whenever I tried kneading the dough, it would inevitably fall apart. And what I ended up doing instead was I just kind of composed the dough, put it together, and I found I got amazing results. And, you know, then I did some research to find out what could be causing it. And it really basically had to do with the water. So that kind of got me thinking.
What did you say it had to do with the water? What was the deal with the water?
It's a very hard water. There's a lot of mineral content. The pH is somewhat higher. I mean, water pH can vary considerably. And then there's also a magnesium. I think it's magnesium phosphates or magnesium sulfates in a higher concentration in the water, which somehow cause a reaction in the dough to cause the gluten to align more rapidly.
Hmm.
But it can also, at the same time, cause, if you were to knead the dough or work it, could also cause the dough to kind of disintegrate and fall apart.
I see.
And then this kind of stayed in my head for a number of years, this whole experience. And then I was asked by a wonderful chef named Cesare Casella to do a James Beard dinner, provide him with bread for a James Beard dinner, of recipes based on the cookbook by Apicius, the Roman cookbook.
We're talking ancient,
author.
Yeah, ancient.
Ancient,
Rome.
Yeah. And so it just got me thinking about, like, well, how did they make bread back then? And then I came to the conclusion that there's no way they could have kneaded the bread, you know, the way that we do it now. Otherwise, the Romans would have basically never left the peninsula of Italy. They just would have stayed there. And actually, they would have been conquered by everyone because they would have been too exhausted kneading the bread. And then also just, you know, like all good ideas, the fermented bread that we kind of know and love and nostalgize wouldn't have taken hold if it was a terribly complicated idea. It is something that occurs to some degree in nature.
Mm-hmm. So can you give us the steps to making the bread?
Yeah, there's several ways you can approach it. But let's say you take your dry ingredients, your flour, your salt, and say commercial dry yeast,
right,
and you can mix it together. And then you add some quantity of water based on the amount of flour that you have.
Mm-hmm.
And then basically compose the dough by mixing it together just so that it's even. You don't really have to knead the dough. And then just set it aside and let it go to work. I'm kind of trying to keep it very simple. You know, but there's, you know, a lot of chemical changes to the dough that take place as a change in the pH of the dough during the arc of time that the fermentation takes place.
Once we've let that dough ripen and mature, you have us bake it in a heavy covered pot that we've heated in a really hot oven. What's happening in that pot? Why do you need that pot?
Well, you know, for for baking bread well, you need 70% humidity for at least two-thirds of the total baking time. And basically what happens is that, you know, the first thing that's created when you put the dough in is steam from this relatively cold, wet blob going into the, onto this hot surface. And that steam allows for the expansion of the surface of the dough, so you get like a really good what's called an oven spring. The dough doesn't form a crust or a skin, preventing the dough from opening up. This also allows for other gases that that are inside the dough to escape out the dough.
Right. So in the recipe, as I recall, you have us bake it with the lid on for quite a period of time until the bread has reached the right expansion, and then we take it off and finish the baking process.
Yes. Just like if you were using a bread oven, a traditional bread oven, you'd open up a damper, which is basically taking the lid off the pot. And what this does is it allows for the bread to dry out even more, and that's where you get the coloration on the crust.
Aha. Jim, it's such an interesting technique. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome, Lynn. Thank you.
You can find Jim Leahy at his Sullivan Street Bakery in New York City. Jim's book is My Bread, The Revolutionary No Work, No Need Method. You can find the recipe for his bread on the website, splendidtable.org. And I'm in one of those classic cooking moments. Pardon the triteness, but it's gray and cold outside, and I want homemade soup. Now, I am not talking about any soup. I want vegetable soup. And this gives me a great chance to talk about improvising your own soup, which I really would love you to try. Now, when you start to improvise, you've really got three big opportunities. You can create three entirely different style soups with the exact same ingredients. The difference is in how you begin cooking the soup. And here's what I mean. For a bold and sturdy soup, you start the soup by first browning the onions and some of the vegetables in a good flavored fat. That's going to make them bold and exciting. Then you add the liquid and the seasonings and you cook the soup. If you want mellow flavors, start out with that same oil or good-tasting fat, warm it, add the vegetables, turn the heat down low, put the lid on the pot, and let them stew until they're really soft. Then add the liquid and all the other seasonings and the vegetables. They get to be very soft and lovely and melt into each other. Now, for really clean, pure, true flavors, just put everything all in the pot at once, add the water, and start simmering. Now, there's just one last trick. Every soup should have a flavor booster, something that lifts the tastes of the other ingredients. It could be a few dashes of Asian fish sauce, which, by the way, completely disappears into the soup. You never taste it. Maybe some red wine, mushrooms, tomatoes, or a piece of the rind of Parmigiano Reggiano cheese. Now, I'm going to post our Building a Soup guide up on the website. You can check it out at splendidtable.org. When you want to take on a new way of cooking and eating, you should get your cliff notes from people who have been there and done that for a long time. Now, India's had 3,000 years to nail down vegetarian cuisines. Frankly, I don't think anybody does it better. Now, you can get a glimmer of the possibilities in the book 660 Curries, The Gateway to Indian Cooking. It's by food writer and teacher Raghavan Iyer, and Raghavan's here with us. Hey, Raghavan, welcome.
Thanks for having me here, Lynn.
Yeah, I'm thinking about when we go to an Indian restaurant, no matter what you order, usually everything is put down along with this bowl of soupy lentils that's called dal. We look at it and think it's soup. But what is dal to an Indian?
It means many things to us. I always say dal defines an Indian because it's so quintessential to the way we eat. Every meal has dal with it. And dal to us signifies a couple of things. One, it signifies a cooked legume curry. And it also means a lentil that's been split open. And we've got over 60 varieties of lentils, beans, and peas. And so from a standpoint of protein source and nutrients, it's really a fantastic way to eat, not to mention cheap, cheap, cheap. It is quick cooking. A lot of the lentils can be very quick cooking.
Right.
And again, you know, when you look at the fact that it's actually split open, that expedites the cooking time. in India, everything is served at the same time. And even in households that do eat meat, they will follow a vegetarian lifestyle for the most part. And so the dal comes into play beautifully for that. So in the context of a meal, you will have maybe a vegetable or two to go along on the side. You'll have a dal of some kind.
Right.
You'll have, if they eat meats, they'll have maybe a meat maybe 2-3 times a week.
Right.
Fish and seafood more so in the coastal areas. But the two things that you'll always find on a plate, no matter where you are, is either rice or bread. Mm-hmm. And the other thing you will find is a dal of some kind.
So what are the basics of making a dal?
It's very simple. I say if you can bring a pot of water to a boil with the lentil, you know how to do it. It's a very simple process. We actually flavor the dal after the dal is cooked. And so when you take, to give an example, walking you through a process of making it, you take a cup of red lentils. You add a couple of cups of water to that, bring it to a boil, and then just let it simmer away. You can do it uncovered very easily. And then while the pot of dal is cooking, you can actually put together your spice packet or your flavor base. To do that, it's very simple. You take a skillet, add a little bit of canola oil, which is obviously healthier, but if you really want to splurge, you could add a little bit of clarified butter to that.
Mm-hmm. Which is called ghee.
Which is called ghee.
Yeah.
And so when the oil is nice and hot, I will maybe throw in about a teaspoon of cumin seeds. And once it hits the oil, when it's hot, it sizzles and it turns aromatic and nutty and turns reddish brown. And then immediately I'll have maybe a half a red onion thinly sliced along with a couple of cloves of garlic and ginger. So you can throw that in and let that continue to brown and clarify. And then you can add some chilies for the heat. And if you want a little color, you could throw in some tomatoes and fresh cilantro with a little bit of ground turmeric, because the turmeric also really helps in the whole process of
digestion. It makes
everything
beautiful, yellow, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you've got a little bit of salt in that you're going to add, and you're going to take that little simmering skillet of the caramelized onions and the tomatoes, and you're going to add that to the cooked dal and let that continue to sing together for about 5 minutes, turn it off, and you've got a fantastic pot of dal at a moment's notice.
So you always cook, and I'm thinking also red lentils cook in 10, 15, maybe 20 minutes, so it's really fast.
It's very fast.
So you always do the basic lentils, and then you just can add the seasoning as you want to create it.
Absolutely. And oftentimes, too, you can actually take all those 60 varieties of lentils, beans, and peas and use the same flavor base I talked about. And then you will actually see 60 distinct flavors come alive. 60 recipes free of charge.
But it's so interesting because there's an infinite, you know, sense of possibility here. You can change that seasoning mix or whatever. One of the other things is could I make dal ahead and then just reheat it?
Oh, it reheats beautifully well. It freezes wonderfully. Oftentimes when you're entertaining, to me, the best thing to do is to do your dal ahead of time and then just rewarm it in a microwave or even stovetop. And you've got to – and it's interesting. The longer it sits also, it starts to change in flavor. So the next day, it's no longer a leftover. It's actually a new dish.
Raghavan, this is miraculous. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me, Lynn.
Raghavan Iyer's book is 660 Curries, The Gateway to Indian Cooking. Well, Raghavan left us with a recipe for slow-roasted bell pepper with red lentils. Try it as a one-dish supper with flatbread. I mean, Indian flatbread is great, but even whole wheat pita is going to work really well here.
Don't be late. Beans on the plate. Don't be late. Beans on a plate. Don't be shy. Piece of pie. Don't be late. Beans on a plate. Don't be shy and don't be late. Piece of pie. Beans on a plate.
You want inspiration for eating on the cheap? You just track the bean, the pea, and the lentil around the globe. You talk about ingenuity. Raghavan Iyer gave us a hint of what India does with legumes. I mean, it's practically a sub-cuisine there. But then there's Latin America, and there's Africa, and there's the Mediterranean. And do not overlook our backyard. This is the hunting ground of Jane and Michael Stern of RoadFood.com. Hey, you guys, good to have you back. Hey, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
Hey, beets turn up all the time, don't they?
Right, absolutely. The most obvious, of course, are baked beans in New England, but Michael and I found a revelation in Charleston, South Carolina. The soul food restaurants in Charleston make lima beans that are transcendent.
Well, the thing about these lima beans is if you look at a menu in one of these restaurants, the menu says lima beans. Not that interesting. When you order the lima beans, what you get is a bowl full of these big khaki-colored pods in a kind of a soupy gravy, and also maybe a pound of pork along with them. But really good, kind of wonderful pork, like neck bones that you can gnaw on, pigtails that are basically the best, most delicious fatty part of the pig you could possibly eat, so that for maybe $6 or $7, you get what they call a lima bean supper that is really about two or three suppers in one or two bowls.
You know, it's funny because lima beans are one of the most hated foods in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, when people write their, you know, 10 worst foods in the world, maybe Brussels sprouts is right under it, but lima bean seems to be across the board considered to be an incredibly disgusting thing to eat. But I will go on record as saying that I would challenge any lima bean hater to go to soul food restaurants in Charleston, eat lima bean supper, and tell me they still don't like it.
Is this a local specialty? Because I know you guys have traveled all over the South.
As far as we can see, I mean, of course, you'll see butter beans throughout the South, and those can be wonderful, too. But the idea of a lima bean supper, as far as we've seen, is unique to Charleston and unique to the soul food restaurants of Charleston, not to the kind of fancier ones where you're going to get shrimp and grits and so forth.
Mm-hmm. I think our favorite place that we found to eat lima bean supper in Charleston is called Bertha's Kitchen.
And Bertha's, it's kind of cafeteria style, but what you do basically is walk up to the counter and consult with one of the people in the kitchen about exactly how you want your meal made. I mean, this is really made to order in the sense that you want a few pigtails, a lot of pigtails. You want more neck bones, less neck bones. You want the neck bones in a separate bowl from the lima beans. Mm-hmm. You want cornbread on the side. Everything is sort of put together to order. And what was great is when Jane and I went there, we were the first people to place an order at lunchtime. The place opens at 11, and we were there at 11. And therefore, when we got our two trays full of food, and I mean full of food, and we're about to sit down, we were also given the television remote control, which meant that it was up to us to turn on the TV in the dining room and choose what to watch.
How much does this cost?
You cannot spend more than $10 for a tray-filling meal.
The lima bean supper, including cornbread and, you know, the usual gigantic sweet iced tea, was $7 at Bertha's and probably around the same at Ernie's, which is also a great place to eat.
Ernie's is especially wonderful because...
Oh, it's $6 at Ernie's.
$6, $7. We had fried chicken. We had, you know, some sweet potato pie for dessert. Everything was maybe $20 for the two of us. Ernie's, though, I have to tell you, is one of the wonderful things about Ernie's. It's a very popular place. There is no sign outside whatsoever. Everyone just knows where it is.
So if you want to get to Ernie's, you've got to ask a local where Ernie's is. Because
ask a local where Ernie's is.
Not or
just
tell you.
Walk down the street and start sniffing for that good ham cooking.
Hey, guys, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, bye.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, every week you can hear the Sterns here, but anytime you want, you can get their road food finds. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, this week the question is, what might be turning up in your cereal bowl soon? Well, we're going to be back with that answer in a moment, and we're going to be taking your calls. The number's 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment. You can join us at 800-537-5252 or get to us online at splendidtable.org. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what might you be seeing in your cereal bowl soon? Well, the answer is paranoia. British papers are reporting that Kellogg's wants to stamp out fake flakes by laser etching their name into each of their Kellogg's cornflakes. Now, a Kellogg food technologist in the UK, Helen Lyons, explains how they're going to make sure you're getting the quality that you deserve. She says, we're constantly looking at new ways to reaffirm this, and giving our golden flakes of corn an official stamp of approval could be the answer. This is branding that takes the turn into the world of the absurd.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
It is time to turn to you and your questions. You can find us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Okay, let's see. Who is calling? We have got Carol calling from Los Angeles. Carol, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I want to talk about cooking phobias.
Oh, one of my favorite subjects.
I love beautiful food. I love eating it. I love looking at it. I love listening to your show. But whenever I cook, it turns out horrible. And I have a block now. I'm afraid to do it.
Yeah, well, I can understand. I mean, I have to confess, I mean, this is me trying to grow flowers. I've always dreamed of a cutting garden. If it's an herb, it grows for me. If I try to grow a flower, it goes kaput, which is why I believe I was meant to support people who grow flowers. Yeah, but first of all, let's get one thing straight. Not everyone was meant to cook. It's just like not all of us, you know, were meant to be computer experts.
Yeah.
Okay?
Tell me, and maybe I'm misunderstanding it. My friends who can cook, when you say, oh, can I have the recipe? And I've heard you say it on the show. They go, oh, you know, put a little bit of that in, I don't know. A little bit for me doesn't turn out right.
No, well, I understand that. I understand that because, again, you know, and maybe I'm first of all, often what you're hearing me say, and I think you're hearing a lot of people who just, you know, they've been cooking for a long time, is you don't know how much you put in because you just kind of do it.
Right.
But one of the first things to consider, like, for instance, when it comes to seasonings, taste them before you add them. It's something I overlooked for a long time. For instance, if you put dill and tarragon into a dish together, they're two flavors that they echo each other, okay, and B, together they taste blech. But how would you know that? You take a little bit of the dill and a little bit of the tarragon on your tongue, and you feel that. You take a little bit of the chili powder and a teeny bit of the soy sauce, and you taste it. You see what a combination is like. But you know what I think would be most helpful for you?
What?
Is to start with some good basic recipes, not boring, not dull, but just recipes that are going to hold your hand and are going to ensure success. Because half of probably what's going on is you've shaken yourself up. No, and you don't trust your instincts.
Absolutely true.
And the other thing is, remember, when a dish doesn't work, it's one dish in your whole life. No, but it's true.
I mean, you're right.
It's not the end of the world. You want to know how many dishes don't work at our house? You know, all those recipes people put into print, they're usually the product of an awful lot of other recipes that never worked.
Right.
And when the dog won't eat it, you know you're in real trouble. But this is the thing. No, I'm thinking, you know, Mark Bittman did the book How to Cook Everything. It's a huge, thick book. But Mark Bittman does very simple recipes. And if you look at his column in the New York Times, The Minimalist, that's a good place to go.
Do you have suggestions? And I mean, it's like I'm a baby. Can you tell me basic recipes that that I could go to and I could do them and do them until I do them well, as you said, it sort of as a foundation.
Right. Okay. I would learn how to saute a chicken. And you could go to anywhere from Julia Child, who will hold your hand through two pages, but by gum, you will get a beautifully sauteed chicken.
Are you saying a whole chicken or chicken part?
Chicken parts.
Okay.
It could even be the breast. It could be whatever. But once you understand how a saute works, you can saute a piece of fish. You can saute a piece of chicken.
Fantastic.
So learn that, and why not learn it through chicken? It's relatively inexpensive.
Okay. I have her book, so I've got that.
Now, learn how to cook vegetables. And there you've got a couple of choices. You can steam them, which is very easy. You can boil them. You can roast them. You can saute them. But again, a lot of basic books have it. But the idea is just learning how to steam a vegetable and then put some herbs on it with a little bit of olive oil, you'll be home free.
And how will I know
when they're done?
When they're done, what seasonings to put them and how much olive oil?
You're going to dress it. You always start with a little bit. If you have a pound of carrots and you've steamed them, you'll taste them to know they're done. Mm-hmm. You might want them crunchy. You might want them not. Mm-hmm. You might want them more done. And then you will start out with a teaspoon of olive oil.
A teaspoon. Okay.
Just start out with a teaspoon. Taste it. Taste a nibble on the edge. Mm-hmm. Add a teeny bit more.
Okay?
Okay?
This is great. You've just given me like the basis for making meals. Thank you. Thank you so much for your time.
Hey, you are welcome.
Bye.
Bye. It's interesting because I think we live in a culture where we're expected to know things. And you know, not all of us have the same skill set. Not all of us have the time to get the exposure. So nowhere is it written everybody's got to cook. Call us, 800-537-5252. We have got Steve on the line from Scotts Bluff, Nebraska. Hey, Steve, what do you want to talk about?
Yes, Lynn. My wife is going to be having a birthday here shortly, and I wanted to do something romantic for her at home without breaking the budget, because she's told me that we definitely have to hold the line, and so I just need some ideas.
What does she love?
She's pretty open to just about anything. I know that she doesn't like fishy-smelling or fishy-tasting fish.
Okay. Well, you know, all right. But that also, fish, lamentably, tends to be a bit on the pricey side. So you can eliminate that entirely, you know, and you wouldn't miss anything. And you know, Nora Ephron's take on eating fish is you never make fish for a special gathering because
right.
it goes down so easily. People eat and then they leave. You want them to chew on things.
Yeah.
You know, think about it. Now we get into some interesting areas here, because I'm thinking you want to make a romantic dinner, right?
Right.
Now, you don't necessarily want to be chained to the stove.
Correct.
Right? So in the best of all possible worlds, we would have a meal that you could have done ahead. You could have even had it waiting in the freezer. Right?
Well, that sounds excellent.
Or at least a good part of it. And this is where I think... consider doing a fabulous stew and maybe something classic. I'm still thinking about, you know, the aftermath of Julie and Julia. Boeuf bourguignon, you know, beef in Burgundy wine, and you don't have to spend a fortune on the wine. You get a Malbec from Argentina, and it's going to cost you $8. You'll drink it and love it, and you'll cook with another bottle of it. Yes, and it'll be fabulous. Okay, so we're not talking breaking the budget. You want to make it with chuck, because chuck is the most wonderful meat for stew. It has great flavor, and it has good marbling. That's not expensive.
Well, that sounds great. I know that my wife has also requested that I make French butter croissants, and did those go well with the stew?
I don't know if I'd want to do butter croissants with the stew. But, I mean, normally I always think of it as breakfast. I'm sorry. I'm just such a traditionalist. But I wonder, this is outrageous. You ready for this? How about you make the croissant, and you split it open, and you put it into a skillet with butter, and you pan fry it a bit in butter. You sprinkle some sugar on that. You open it up on the plate so it looks like two crescent moons, you know, back to back.
Right.
And then you could pile on that scoops of the best ice cream you could get your hands on.
Oh, terrific.
Right. Now, it's going to be buttery and rich. And then what you want to do is put a butterscotch sauce on that, which is merely butter, brown sugar, vanilla. And then you can both retire to wherever you want to retire.
Well, that sounds wonderful.
It's
Thank
a little
you.
Rich. I'd throw a green salad in there if I could.
I think
you'll have a real, you know, delight. And if you want to lighten the dessert, you could do sautéed apples on top Ooh. Of that crisp, warm croissant that has the sugar caramelized on it. So that's the lighter version of this whole thing.
Well, thank you so much. You have just a wonderful, infectious way of drawing people into the kitchen and making food fun. So
thank you for all you do. Thank you. Hey, happy birthday to her.
I will. I will tell her. Thank you so very much.
Take care, Steve. Bye.
Bye-bye.
I don't know. You know, buff bourguignon for seduction, yeah, you're going to sleep really well, but it's fabulous food. Call us, 800-537-5252, or send us an email. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. I don't know what it is, but as soon as the weather turns cold, people want to know about broth and stock and what is the difference. So I actually decided, because I have a theory, but I wanted to get it right, so I went and hit the books. And one of the great sources is Tom Stobart. And he talks about the fact that both of them are made more or less the same way, okay? But the difference is stock is usually what you then make a broth from. In so many words, stock is the beginning of a sauce. It's the beginning of a soup, etc. Whereas broth is designed to be eaten on its own. Well, quite frankly, I don't think he's right. I think in today's cooking, the two of them are really interchangeable. So whether it's stock or whether it's broth, it's a liquid that has picked up through cooking the flavor of meat or fish or vegetables or poultry, and it is something that then becomes either a dish you eat all by itself or it becomes the foundation of many other things. You can send us an email at splendidtable.org or you can call us 800-537-5252. We have got Tara on the line from Santa Monica. Tara, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call.
You are welcome.
I want to talk about my grandmother's southern recipes and turning them into dishes with vegetarian options. I inherited a cookbook of hers from the 70s called Secrets from a Southern Kitchen, Great Recipes of the Old South.
Uh-huh.
They're all of her dishes that she was famous for, her turnip greens, her dumplings, her goulash. Everything in there is fabulous, and I remember tasting these with her at her table. But I can't recreate them because everything had bacon fat, which made it delicious. And I'm a vegetarian, so I'd love some options how to turn it into something that I can enjoy with my family.
Well, and I understand the problem because it's hard to recreate that wonderful taste, you know, you get from smoked pork and bacon and that kind of thing. I mean, yes, you could use smoked soy products and get an echo of that. But, you know, I would say why not try to duplicate it, but try to come up with something that's going to carry that same sense of taste. Give me one of the dishes that you'd like to let's use one as an example and work from
there. Okay, one as an example would be her Florida hash. And it's got onions, pepper, celery, but it's mainly hamburger meat.
Right.
With tomatoes and rice, and she's got chili powder in there. And it's basically a casserole that she made with hamburger meat and pork fat.
Boy, does that sound good. Okay, now, I would try to do it with olive oil. It's going to taste a bit different, but I'd try to do it with olive oil. And do you eat butter? Do you eat dairy?
Yes.
You do. I would do olive oil and a bit of butter because it's really rich tasting, okay? And I would bet you there's so much flavor in those vegetables, especially if you brown them and really sauté them, because that's going to bring up all their rich flavor. I don't think you're going to miss a lot of the meat.
Okay.
And if you cook the rice with the vegetables or some of the vegetables, that would be fabulous too. Because you want to sort of spike the rice. I mean, one of the things you could do for the rice is take some butter, brown some onion in it, add some tomato, add some clove, add cinnamon, and add a little bit of the chili powder. Then add the rice and whatever water you need to cook the rice in, or vegetable broth. And you've already now made the rice delicious. You'll have the vegetable sauté. That'll be delicious. You'll make the casserole. You'll put it in the oven.
Wonderful. Now, what about her dumplings? I mean, what could I make dumplings to go with? Like, is there a stew that would be good?
You could do almost any vegetable soup that you see, or grain and bean soup with the seasonings that she loved, okay? And then the dumplings would – now, normally, dumplings are very close to being like biscuit recipes. And the idea is that you drop them once the stew is just about done. And, you know, this time of year, you're living in California, right?
Right.
Okay, so let's think about – you could do a stew using eggplant, using collard greens – using a ton of onion, garlic. I'm trying to think. You could even do turnips in there, believe it or not. You could do tomatoes. You see what I mean? Okay.
Yeah.
And a vegetable broth. Add the spices and the seasonings that really give them the flavor. Look at the seasonings in that book. And those are the seasonings you carry over. And let that cook until you get it just where you want it. And then the idea is that you would drop the dumplings into that liquid, cover the pot, and let it very, very gently simmer because they're going to steam.
Oh,
and
wow.
I think it should work.
That sounds great.
Hey, thanks for a great call.
Thanks, Lynn.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. This idea of trying to get the meat out of the recipe, just remember there's all kinds of tricks. There's acids, there's browning, there's spices. There's also just tasting the pure flavor of something that you've steamed and you've just served as it is with maybe coarse salt on it. It could be a vegetable, it could be a grain, and that in itself is really something gorgeous. Well, that is the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252, or check us out on Facebook. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from the actor Orson Welles. He said, "My doctor told me to stop having intimate dinners for four unless there were three other people present." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. You can meet people who love food at food.gather.com. You'll find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. And also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lukey. Our website is managed by Roger Miller, Sarah Lear, and Julia Schrankler. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.